Hey there, listeners. Vermont Edition co-host Michaela Lafrac here. The podcast you're about to listen to has been edited and condensed for clarity and brevity. Enjoy.
Welcome to the VPR and Vermont PBS debates. I'm Michaela Lafrac, one of the hosts of Vermont Edition. Today, we're bringing you our sixth debate this season. It's part of the VPR Vermont PBS coverage of statewide and federal elections ahead of the August 9th primary election. Today, it's the Democratic candidates running for lieutenant governor. Joining me live today in the Vermont PBS studio in downtown Winooski are Woodstock Representative Charlie Kimball, former Danville Representative Kitty Toll, Burlington's Patricia Preston, president of the nonprofit Vermont Council on World Affairs, and former Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman of Hinesburg. All right, welcome to the program. Here is the format we are going to use today. In our first segment, I'll ask common questions to all of the candidates. They'll each have 60 seconds to answer. Short follow-up questions and answers are possible. In the second segment, the candidates will ask each other questions. Each candidate will be given 30 seconds to ask a question and 60 seconds to answer. Follow-ups are also possible. Then we'll do a lightning round of questions with very brief answers, 10 seconds or less. And we'll conclude with 1 minute closing statements from each candidate. So let's begin. We'll start with questions for all of you. And again, please limit your answers to 60 seconds. And a reminder, I may ask follow-up questions. In Vermont, the lieutenant governor presides over the state Senate and casts tie-breaking votes and assists with committee assignments. They also act as governor if the elected one is incapacitated. But the lieutenant governor has no major lawmaking or leadership duties day-to-day. At the end of your two-year term, if elected, what do you hope you will have accomplished? Let's begin with Charlie Kimball.
Well, thank you, Michaela. Great to be here, and thank you for hosting. I decided to run for lieutenant governor so I could focus on the issues that I've already been addressing in the state legislature, working in economic development and workforce development. So I really wanted to use the platform of the lieutenant governor's office to bring together those people around workforce development to make sure that the people that are in Vermont have an opportunity to have a meaningful career in which they both have sustainable work and meaningful work. So I think what I would like to see at the end of 2 years is a better coordinated system among all of the education providers and skill providers and employers throughout the state to make sure that people do have that opportunity to get a career that is meaningful to them, where they can earn more money and sustain themselves, and also to meet the needs of employers that are in the state that are right now searching for additional employees to meet their existing needs. So at the end of 2 years, that's what I would like to see, a better system of workforce development in the state. Thank you.
Now, Representative Kimball, a majority of the 10 most recent lieutenant governors have gone on to be a governor or congressperson or their party's nominee for one of those roles. Right. Clearly, a lot of political aspirations from former lieutenant governors. What are your political aspirations?
Well, I'm really seeking this office because I think this is a great job. I'm looking at using that office to accomplish those things that really are important to me, really in workforce development, and also that translates into housing, too, because you can't have a workforce without housing. So I'm not doing it with the intention of running for an additional office after that. I really like this job. It's really an honor. It would be an honor to represent the state of Vermont across all towns, all committees, all agencies, and really across all governments. So that's what I look forward to in this position. Now, never say never. If you're in the position where you're called upon by your party to run for a different office, have to ask that question, have to consider it. But that is not why I'm running now.
Kitty Toll, if elected lieutenant governor, what do you hope you will have accomplished at the end of your term?
Thank you, Michaela, and thank you for having us today. At the end of 2 years, I hope to accomplish the concerns that I'm hearing from Vermonters across the state. And even though the lieutenant governor's office is not working on policy and will not be taking votes, the lieutenant governor can elevate the concerns of Vermonters and work in the building and be sure policy committees and members are hearing those concerns. I have spent 12 years in the legislature, and I chaired the House Appropriations Committee, so I have a full understanding of the state budget. And when I think of issues that I'm hearing across the state concerning broadband and childcare and housing and climate change, I know the federal dollars that are in place can definitely transform many areas in this state. And I plan to be a very loud voice on ensuring that the federal dollars are spent in areas that can help Vermonters, and also that we do get them spent and none of them have to go back.
Now, as you mentioned, you served in the Vermont legislature for more than a decade. Why run for this position instead of another term in the legislature?
That's a very good question. My time in the legislature, I loved more than anything. I was there for 12 years. You really do become a family, and working on policy and working on the budget was a true, not just an experience, but a true joy in my life. I did step away in 2020 to seek new opportunities and new experiences. I did not know where that would lead to me, where that would lead me. I was just curious and waiting to see what was open. And this is a job that has always intrigued me because I feel it can be dovetailed and integrated into the legislative process and truly a bridge from the executive branch into the legislature. And that's what I hope to do, that I can take these concerns of Vermonters and actually help to move good policy forward.
Thank you. Patricia Preston.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to Michaela, to VPR for hosting, and to my fellow candidates here on the stage this evening. I am running for Lieutenant Governor because I love Vermont and because I believe in the promise of this state. I hope that at the end of 2 years, I'm able to, and Vermonters are able to see, that I've helped Vermont live up to that promise. That means addressing climate action. That means addressing affordability. And that means addressing the economy in our rural communities. I've been doing this work for over a decade now at the Vermont Council on Rural Affairs, where I've been traveling the state, elevating the voices of Vermonters, hosting educational forums and bringing folks together to look at Vermont's most pressing issues. And I'll intend to continue to do that work as Lieutenant Governor to help fulfill the promise. Thank you.
Patricia Preston, is there a former Lieutenant Governor who you look up to, who you believe accomplished a lot in this position that you'd like to emulate?
So I am really hopeful to have a fifth Lieutenant Governor in this office that is a female. And that being said, I've often looked to many of the women that have held the position, or the few women that have held the position, actually. And that woman would be Madeline Cunin, actually.
Thank you. Former Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, excuse me.
That's good. That's Mark from Facebook. If I had his money, we'd solve all of our problems. Well, with respect to accomplishments over 2 years, I would lean into the work that I had done the 4 years as Lieutenant Governor, bringing Vermonters into the process, really having them help affect the change that we need to see, both to solve today's immediate pressing problems. We have, as has been mentioned, housing, affordability in general, a rural economy. Broadband at this point is going to be paid for, is going to happen, so I think that'll be accomplished by any of us because the money's there. But we need to create solutions to today's problems while at the same time promoting and putting into place policies that will have long-term positive impacts, particularly around the climate and our rural economy, particularly around food resilience and rural resilience to supply chain problems. And we also need to make sure that we continue progressing forward to making Vermont a welcome place for everyone.
Now, you've already spent two terms as Lieutenant Governor, and you ran for governor and lost. Why do you want this position again?
Well, really because the urgency of the issues of today. As I was on my farm the last couple of years working, feeling the impacts of the climate changing, reading about the challenges and experiencing my friends and neighbors' challenges with costs going up these last couple of years, the fact that we really haven't seen the progress on the climate that we absolutely have to work on from day one and not incrementally. The idea that we can incrementally address many of the issues that we're facing is really no longer an option. We have 20, 30 years of deferred maintenance on our schools, on our rural economy, on the people of our state, investing in our state colleges, investing in affordable housing in our village and town centers. To me, returning to the office of Lieutenant Governor, I will draw on those connections all across the state and be able to bring people in right away.
Well, a number of you brought up affordable housing, so let's dive into that topic in a bit more detail. Now, the shortage of affordable housing is a well-documented issue in Vermont at this point. I'd like to hear a specific element of this crisis or an innovative policy solution, a specific one, again, that you would try to highlight in your role as Lieutenant Governor. Let's begin with Kitty Toll.
Thank you for that question. I've spent a lot of time traveling across Vermont, and I was in the southern part of the state, and I was speaking to a mother who has a daughter who has disabilities. And she said it's absolutely impossible for her daughter to find any housing that would work for her disabilities. And there's a huge shortage of housing at every level, but we cannot forget those that are disabled. And so I would have a real focus to elevate housing issues that would address all Vermonters. And using some innovative ideas like the auxiliary dwelling units that are just outside of other properties, they're small, manageable housing projects that would work, or individuals that are willing to convert garages. And so there can be some support services and housing nearby. But my focus, one of my focuses would be certainly housing disabled people so they can live independently.
And you mentioned elevating that specific issue. How exactly do you do that as Lieutenant Governor?
You do that in the State House with your voice. And when I left the State House, which was not too long ago, just 2 years ago, I know many of the members of the legislature and I know the chairs of committees, and it's through conversations. And I would like to open up the Lieutenant Governor's office to have these conversations and to use it for fact-finding and use it for information gathering and bring people in and create ideas together, not solely, but together as groups, and to work across party lines.
Thank you. Patricia Preston.
Great. Thank you for this question. I think that the housing crisis that we're facing in this state right now is one of the greatest crises that we see. I was actually in Stowe very recently, and I was speaking to some business owners there. And one of the biggest things that they're facing is they cannot have a workforce because there's no housing for that workforce. And many of them have different opportunities to build housing on site or renovate housing, but there are some prohibiting factors because of Act 250. Act 250 was created with the best of intentions in the 70s, but I do believe that it needs to be modernized so that we can address the housing crisis and make sure that we can find housing for Vermonters that are here or those that want to move into the state and be a part of the workforce in our community. I'd also say that we really need to make sure that we're looking at those most disproportionately impacted by the housing crisis, and that is the BIPOC community. So I would make sure that those voices are heard and their needs would be met in making any decisions.
Well, you brought up Act 250. Just recently, Governor Scott vetoed a bill that would have updated Act 250. He said the updates would have made new development projects even more cumbersome. Do you agree?
Yeah, I understand that's why he vetoed the bill. I would say that what we need to do is modernize the bill so that we can actually build housing and move forward. And
so, modernize, what do you mean by that?
What I mean is there's a lot of, so for example, there are things in the bill that aren't necessarily constructive today as things stand. So I think that the world has moved on where Act 250 was created in the 70s. And that an example of that is there was a type of tree that needed to be planted on a ridgeline for a building to be put up in Stowe. Mm-hmm. And that's no longer actually accessible in that area because of the shading. And so there's little things like that just need to be modernized to make building and the regulations within Act 250 more accessible.
Thank you.
Yeah.
David Zuckerman.
Well, I think there's a number of topics in housing that need to be addressed. We have seen long-term rentals being closed down on everyday Vermonters, workers in Vermont, for Airbnb and short-term rentals. I think we need to at least explore whether or not some of the profits from Airbnbs can be invested into more affordable housing and construction of more rental housing. At least have the conversation. We need to look into vacant buildings that aren't occupied, whether they're old business buildings that aren't used as much anymore because they're doing more work remotely, or they've been vacant for other reasons. How can the state either invest or incentivize those buildings to be turned into more housing? We also could look into more sewer and septic system or wastewater systems in our town and village centers, because if we develop in our town and village centers affordable community-based housing, we'll actually help rebuild our rural economy as well. So there's a number of different factors that could go into the process of building more affordable housing.
Thank you. Now, you brought up Airbnb, and an article is making the rounds on Twitter this week about a millennial couple who earns about $100,000 a month from their 15 Airbnb properties around the state. So big topic of conversation right now. Do you think the state should be raising taxes or taking another tack to try to disincentivize that type of property purchasing for investments like Airbnbs?
Well, let's be clear. Housing is a basic right and should be a basic right. And as it becomes more and more profit-driven, whether it's the example you gave or nationwide, I don't know if others are getting these mailings, but I get mailings regularly. I'll buy your house for cash. As the investment world turns housing into a commodity, we have to fight back. We have to say housing is more than a commodity. It's more than a profit motive. It is a fundamental piece of life and our communities. So I am more than willing to look at the idea of either taxes or other regulations to make short-term rentals on par with the ability to make affordable housing.
Thank you. Representative Kimball.
Yeah, thank you. When I first started running, one person said, what is the one thing that you hope to accomplish? What if you could only do one thing, what would it be? And my first answer was workforce development, but it immediately turned towards housing. It is the most critical factor that we face. And there's a few reasons for it. First is that we haven't built new housing at the rate that we should have been building it for the last 40 years. And so we do need to build new. Second is that we need to rehabilitate existing housing. There's a lot of old housing stock that's in the state that needs to be rehabilitated in improving its standards and its quality of life for the tenants and occupants. And the third is, as has been referenced, is reuse of existing buildings. But there's a couple of things. One is trying to make sure that the shared equity model that's being developed and promulgated by many of our housing partners in the state has a real leg up. And this ensures permanent affordability for housing for locals. I would like to see more of that shared equity concept developed throughout the state. For otherwise, it's really hard to manage, monitor, regulate as to what the rentals are. And I'd like to see more of that throughout Vermont.
Now, you've served in the legislature. These are clearly issues that the legislature is trying to address. How would you better address them as lieutenant governor than you are right now in a lawmaking position?
Well, there's a couple things. One, again, the Office of Lieutenant Governor has the ability to convene different partners and stakeholders. I would really continue to work with the very qualified housing partners we have already. VHFA is setting something up with the utilities called the Weatherization Repayment Assistance Program, which is one way to address affordability is how do you make it so it's costs less to heat your home, and how do you afford the money to pay for it? It's on average about $10,000 to weatherize a home. So they've come up with an innovative way to figure out, we'll just add it to your utility bill, the net impact on you is zero, and you get a more comfortable living space. That kind of innovative program is what we need to pursue. I would work with the housing partners and with your utilities to do that type of thing.
Thank you. Let's move on. Between 2020 and 2021, Vermont experienced a 33% increase in fatal opioid overdoses. The synthetic opioid fentanyl was involved in the vast majority of those overdoses, 93% compared to just 10% about a decade ago. If elected lieutenant governor, what would you do to push the legislature and the governor to better protect Vermonters from fentanyl? Let's begin with Patricia Preston.
We need to address this issue, and that's one of the reasons why I'm incredibly disappointed by the governor's veto. And I think that one thing that needs to be discussed in all of this is the mental health crisis. Largely, you know, I visited a hospital in central Vermont recently, and it's one that I have frequented often. And when I was on tour, there were key cards that brought you into each room because of the opioid crisis. And there has been a spike in break-ins into these spaces because of COVID-19. And as the world reopened, people not having services to address the mental health needs that they're experiencing. And so I really firmly believe that we need to provide space for folks to go. I think that after we lost the facility in Waterbury, there was never a replacement for that. And the emergency department is not a suitable replacement for folks that are in need.
Would you support the establishment of safe injection sites in Vermont?
I absolutely would, yes. And to clarify, that's the bill I was referencing that the governor vetoed. And I would 100% support that.
Thank you. David Zuckerman.
Thank you, Michaela. I was going to start with the safe injection sites. Certainly the veto was very frustrating, but we need to have safe injection sites. And beyond that, we need to talk about decriminalization. When you have people who have substance abuse disorders and the stigma and the potential criminal repercussions if they come forward really inhibits the ability for folks to seek the help that they need. And certainly some folks end up with opioid substance abuse disorder through mental health challenges that they have. But many have ended up there because of pharmaceuticals that they were given for pain and other reasons, even accidental experimentation. But if we continue to have it as a criminal offense to possess small amounts, that really impedes the ability to bring forward this challenge out of the shadows and into the opportunity for people to seek the help they need, the supports that they need, to get their feet back under them, and to be able to move forward as productive members in our society.
Specifically, what drugs would you like to see decriminalized?
Well, you were specifically asking about opioids. And we've seen that in the underground market, what happens is as a substance becomes more and more profitable by cutting it with more and more deadly drugs, that's why we're seeing the problem we see. And so we really have to look at what is the war on drugs doing? What has it accomplished? We've got more people in prison than any international country in the world. And, of course, we also have highly disproportionate rates of incarceration for communities of color. So the war on drugs and decriminalization is definitely an important topic to talk about.
Thank you. Representative Kimball.
Yeah, thank you. We look at a three-legged stool when addressing the opioid crisis or any kind of addiction, and certainly the unfortunate deaths of so many from overdoses. And the three-legged stool is prevention, enforcement, and treatment. So what can we do more on each one of those areas? We've taken some steps in the state to limit the amount of opioids that could be prescribed by a doctor to reduce the tendency of people to become addicted to that substance. We can do more on prevention. A lot of it has to do with the health of a household and the health of a community. And what can we do with that? And talking about increasing their income, increasing the child care, that we can then look at reducing the adverse childhood experiences that the individuals would experience. Enforcement, we do have an issue with enforcement that we need to step that up. It's certainly in Springfield, when I was there last week talking to people about the recent spate of deaths, and one death in particular that was related to an opioid trafficking, that we need to have enforcement that is working effectively with our communities and is keeping our people safe.
If elected Lieutenant Governor, who do you see as potential allies in addressing the opioid crisis?
Well, I would see them first as mental health professionals, medical professionals, law enforcement. So there's a whole group of folks that you want to pull in together, educators, that all are dealing with people that are witnessing or experiencing, suffering from, whatever you want to call it. And I was talking with a school principal earlier this week. It's hard to remember where we've been this week, about recognizing adverse childhood experiences in youth and how to recover from that and what kind of services you put around them. And she was talking about really just having that predictable experience with a reliable adult and creating that environment. So that's one of the things you'd have to do.
Thank you. And Kitty Toll.
Thank you. A piece of this puzzle has to be education. As a former school teacher, the more that we can bring to our children with real understanding, it will help in their later years. People with lived experience need to come in and talk to kids at school. As a teacher, I could preach, counselors could preach, and we could use the jargon and say the things about not using drugs and the importance of not using drugs. Somebody with lived experience who can tell their story is going to have impact on kids. And so education is what I feel is one of the larger pieces of the puzzle. Prevention activities and counseling, available counseling for people is important. And I agree. I was very saddened when the governor vetoed the opioid bill. It didn't even incur, it wouldn't open a pilot site for safe injection sites. It was just for research and data. And we need all the research and data we can have to save lives.
If elected Lieutenant Governor, do you think you would be able to sway the governor in any way on the topic of safe injection sites?
I would certainly want to have that conversation, and I think, as I said earlier, bringing individuals in with lived experiences and even individuals who have used a safe injection site perhaps in another state and how it saves lives and how it can move people to recovery, those are important conversations to hear. It's not simply just a place to go and shoot up. It's a place to be identified to move your life on the road to recovery.
Thank you. Let's move on. Now, we've brought up Governor Phil Scott a bit. As we all know, he is running for a fourth term this year. Whoever wins the election, being Lieutenant Governor will mean working closely with the governor, who might have different views on you than you on major issues. What is one issue during the last legislative session on which you would have pushed Governor Scott to act differently? Let's begin with David Zuckerman.
What's one? I mean, he vetoed 11 bills, and I would probably have pushed him on every single one of those. But in the immediate term, we have to address the climate, and continuing to veto anything and everything, climate is at the top of the agenda in terms of making sure we are adjusting into a more proactive stance, from encouraging renewable energy development in Vermont, encouraging more weatherization. Now, yes, we have federal money right now that's helping with weatherization, but we chronically underfunded weatherization for decades in our balanced budgets. And that's been a problem, not only with the governor, but with the legislature. We have to weatherize a tremendous number of homes. We have to build more affordable housing in our town and village centers. And that could be efficient, so again, keeping costs down for our workforce. He's vetoed the minimum wage in the past. A bill didn't get to him this year to raise it to $15, but he's vetoed $15 minimum wage in the past. These are all major issues for everyday Vermonters.
Thank you. Representative Kimball.
So I did have the pleasure of working with the governor's administration in this past legislative session, and we did a lot of very good work together around workforce development, economic recovery from the pandemic. So I'd say that I have a very good relationship with the people in those agencies, whether it's Department of Labor or Agency of Commerce Community Development with whom we worked, and even Agency of Education. So I do have a good relationship with the administration and look forward to working with him in my capacity as Lieutenant Governor if he gets elected. I would say I voted to override vetoes that the governor had vetoed. One was a clean heat standard. If not that, then what? So we're coming back to the table as to, okay, that one didn't work. What else are we going to do to really move aggressively to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and consumption of fossil fuels? So there has to be something else. Perhaps it was too complicated to administer. I think that's what the governor spoke to. So what is the alternative? So I would have pushed for what is the alternative if not that? So there are other bills that I also voted to override, and he vetoed bills about city charters. I voted to override those bills as well.
Thank you. Kitty Toll.
Thank you for the question. I too worked with the administration daily when I was chair of appropriations and have developed that relationship with the different secretaries and commissioners. But focusing directly on the governor and his actions this year, climate is a big issue for me. I feel that he has not moved quickly enough toward climate, and Charlie has just outlined the clean heat standard, and if it's not that, what is it? One thing that I've really disagreed with the governor this year is lack of communication. I feel that waiting until May to put your cards on the table is too late. The communication and the working together needs to happen before. And one of those was with the hospital to prohibit guns in hospitals. That bill was vetoed, and that communication should have been happening in January and February to move an important bill forward. The same with the clean heat standard. More communication is what I would like to see.
Thank you. And Patricia Preston.
As David outlined, there were 11 vetoes, so there's a lot to choose from here. And I think that we just discussed the opioid overdose response services, which I was really disappointed in because we're really then leaving the issue to local communities to respond when it should be a statewide response. I also have other folks on the stage here have now just referenced the clean heat standard. I 100% agree with that as well. We cannot wait any longer to address climate action. Vermont's buildings produce more than 1/3 of state's greenhouse gas emissions. And this is just one example of why at the Vermont Council on World Affairs, we're not seeing our partners look to us as a leader in climate action anymore. We're falling behind, and I think we can be a national leader on this. I also think that part of the impending climate crisis, or not even impending, it's here, has prohibited folks my age from not wanting to have children anymore. And it's a crisis, it's here, it needs to be addressed. And this is one veto I would have disagreed with him on to take action.
Thank you. That concludes the first segment of this debate. The candidates will now have an opportunity to ask each other questions. The questions should not be longer than 30 seconds, and the responses are limited to 60 seconds. And a reminder, you can ask a brief follow-up question either to the same candidate or to a different candidate. We'll begin with Representative Kimball. What's your question?
Thank you. My question is for David Zuckerman. David, you have a long history of being a proud progressive in politics, and you've advocated for and advanced progressive bills and ideas. My question is, you're here in the Democratic primary, and why is that? Why not run for lieutenant governor as a progressive?
Well, I appreciate the question. I've actually run in the Democratic primary for my races for the state Senate, as well as lieutenant governor, as well as governor, and for one main reason. Two main reasons. One is to be collaborative. We've talked a lot in this debate about working with people across different aisles, working with people all across the state with different perspectives. But secondly, we know that the system of voting that we have, and I'd like to see it change, really makes it so that if you run as a third party, you spend more time discussing whether you have a right to run or whether you're a, quote, spoiler. I also have a lot of issues that I agree with the Democratic Party platform on. If you look at the platforms, they're fairly similar between the Democratic and the progressive parties. But sometimes when the policy starts to happen in the legislature or in state government, the progress is not as fast as I think most progressives would like to see, whether they're progressives in the Democratic Party or progressives in the Progressive Party. So I'm very proud to have won both nominations many cycles in a row.
Would you like to ask a follow-up question?
I would, sure. Just a follow-up. Could a progressive win in a statewide contest in Vermont?
I guess I would say yes, because I have. I've run two Senate races and two lieutenant governor races as a progressive Democrat, and I have won all four of those races. I obviously did not win the race for governor, but I think most would acknowledge that the circumstances that I started the race on changed dramatically 8 weeks later, as well as being difficult to beat an incumbent. But I have won with both labels for four cycles.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Kitty Toll.
Thank you. I too, David, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you a question as well.
No apology necessary.
I've built tripartisan coalitions that have allowed state budgets to make it to the finish line and get signed by the governor. In the last debate, you said that Governor Scott would not include you in conversations to address problems facing the state. I'm wondering at this critical moment in our state's history, if the governor is the next governor after the election, how do you see this relationship changing so that you could have a more impactful role?
Sure. A couple things there. One is I certainly have reached out to the governor and offered opportunities to work together. What a governor decides to do is completely up to them. But how I've often impacted policy and policy decisions is not so much inside the building and working with the power players, although I do that. It's really been a track record for over 20 years of working with Vermonters across all political lines. Someone was at my door just the other day, a surveyor working on the land next door to mine. And he said, oh, I'd like to hear you on WVMT. I don't always agree with you, but I really respect that you come on every month, that you state what you believe really clearly. There's things I agree with you, things that I don't, but I'm really glad you talk with and work with everybody. When a constituent out there says that to you, someone you've never met before, I think it shows you're doing something right. So I will work with Vermonters all across the state on these important issues that we've all been talking about to make sure their voices are amplified. And if enough Vermonters speak up, the legislature and the governor can and will do the right thing.
Would you like to ask a follow-up question?
Sure. It's a very crucial time in Vermont history, and to have the two top office holders working together and getting along is very important. How do you see it being different this time for you with the governor?
Well, certainly I've worked with many of the governor's secretaries over the years. I'm more than happy to work with the governor. The governor, whenever he was out of state, certainly informed me, and I did some, usually it's fairly ceremonial, but some important things while he was out of state, signing documents around extradition, for instance, with an individual who needed to be prosecuted in New York for a woman's safety. So reaching out to the governor, I was a senator when he was lieutenant governor. I was a representative when he was a senator. We know each other. We have a very cordial and friendly relationship. And certainly were he to win, I would work well with him. I will also point out that there is another candidate in that race, Brenda Siegel. And I fully support Brenda Siegel in that race. I hope everyone here does and would state that clearly. Because Brenda, I think, agrees with us on far more issues than the governor does. You have to work with everyone, but it's more helpful if you've got someone forward-thinking in that office.
Patricia Preston, it's your turn to ask a question.
Thank you so much. My question is for Kitty. At our last debate, I asked you to explain a vote against decriminalizing possession of 1 ounce of marijuana in 2017. You denied ever having made this vote. So I double-checked our research. And you did, in fact, vote against decriminalizing marijuana. And I even found an article published in the Hardwick Gazette, writing up your vote against decriminalizing 1 ounce of marijuana. And it quoted you as saying you were not convinced of the bill's merits. So I really just wanted to give you an opportunity again to just explain to Vermonters why you voted against decriminalizing the possession of 1 ounce of marijuana and how you explain that vote.
Okay, I'm going to go through a timeline, and I appreciate this, Patricia. And I went back and checked some of my votes, and so I'm not sure where this is coming from. There were four major votes on marijuana. There may have been other votes in between. The first one was on medical marijuana, and it was making updates to the law, and I supported that. Decriminalization, I supported, and this may have been an amendment, or I'll have to go back and really check the records, but I went back as well, and I was a supporter of decriminalization because I saw what happened to many of my classmates in high school who were caught with marijuana and couldn't become sheriffs or couldn't pursue jobs. And so I'm very clear on that. I was a no vote to the legalization, which is different than decriminalization. I was a no vote to legalization because I believed a tax and regulate system needed to be in place, and I did not like the interim step. And then the final bill was I was a no vote for the two plants. I'm sorry, that's the legalization. And then the tax and regulate, I was not able to vote, and that's where I would have had a protest vote for my farmers. But I was not able to vote because I was presiding over the House for that vote.
Would you like to ask a follow-up?
Yeah, I'd be happy to show you where we found that later, just so you can know, because I think it's important to address it to Vermonters.
Absolutely.
And so then I would just say, let's open it up then to still talk about that issue, right? And the ACLU found that Black Vermonters are 6 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than white Vermonters. So what reforms might you make to the criminal justice system to address this as Lieutenant Governor?
Well, the reforms that we put into place to decriminalize, I think, are important. And now that cannabis is legal, those reforms would be completely different, and we're going to be following the new guidelines from the Cannabis Control Board of who can grow and who can sell. And so I don't see that as the issue that it was before, when people that I mentioned in high school who were found with small amounts of pot were unable to pursue jobs and pursue careers. And so I am very clear about decriminalization. It was the legalization of the two plants that I had problems with because I really felt a tax and regulate system needed to be put in place initially.
Thank you. David Zuckerman, it's your turn to ask a question.
Thank you. This is for former Representative Toll. In our climate debate last month, your statements indicated that you had strong reservations about solar fields and wind turbines in Vermont. Last week, you stated that the climate is the number one issue, and you've brought it up today. Currently, Vermont gets large amounts of power from Hydro-Quebec and from gas plants in marginalized communities in Connecticut. To make us more resilient and energy independent, what are your plans for meeting Vermont's future energy needs with in-state production without wind and solar? Or do you plan for us to continue to export our impacts on other communities, particularly BIPOC communities out of state?
Thank you for that question, David. In-state renewable energies is critical. In 2032, I think that our goal is to have 10% in-state renewables. I really feel, and I mentioned at that debate, that we could be higher than that. I feel that we could meet the challenge of 20%, and I've talked with the chair of the Energy Committee, and it appears that we could really get to 25% for in-state renewables. When it comes to wind, the location of them are very important, and what I spoke about were the communities that were fighting against each other on the ridgelines. So there has to be mutual agreement and working together to identify the areas where wind could be developed so that we don't create this impact with communities. We had families fighting against each other and neighbor pitted against neighbor. And the same with solar. I have a nephew who has a south-facing barn that would be perfect for a huge solar array. And so it's the location of them that we have to work on together so that community members and Vermonters can come together to move us forward with green energy.
Would you like to ask a follow-up?
Well, a lot of times the discussion around location and the impediments that exist or may exist are the ways that all of these projects get ground to a halt. We don't have time. If climate is the number one issue, as you stated in the last debate, and climate is as important as you've stated in this debate as well, yes, we have to have community discussions, but we also have to have clear regulations. So how will you move forward with clear regulations to make this happen quickly? The energy
Thank
folks...
Thank you. I'm going to pass it to her.
Thank you. I think this is the good work of our policy committees in working with companies in the green energy field and also with the PUC. We all have to be at the table, and I'm going to use this example probably many times today. When we had severe issues with the pensions, everybody came to the table and a solution was found and we moved forward. And the same will have to be with renewable energy. All stakeholders need to be at the table and to come to an agreement how we can move forward to get to more than 10% in-state renewables.
All right, this concludes the second segment of our program. It's time now for some questions from Vermonters. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions for this debate. And just a reminder to candidates, please limit your answers to 30 seconds. So we're going quickly here. First, Brad in Newbury says, Windsor and Newbury are inappropriate locations for a replacement to the Woodside Juvenile Detention Center. How should the state find a good location for this urgently needed facility? We'll begin with Kitty Toll.
Thank you. I'm very well aware of the issues in Newbury, as it's not far from being a neighboring town. And I know that's it's a very difficult situation, and it's privately owned land by the company. I do not think that the state can be assured if the state chooses not to put a facility there because it's privately owned land, a facility still could end up there. It just may not be run by or have State of Vermont individuals in it. And so that's a consideration that we have to look at.
Thank you. Patricia Preston.
Well, this is actually, it's almost in my backyard here in Orange County where I grew up. And I think that one thing that we need to do when addressing all of these issues in local communities is bring in local voices and make sure that all of their voices are represented, which is something that I've been doing for the last decade as the president and CEO of the Vermont Council on World Affairs. And it would be my strong, as Lieutenant Governor, what I would do is I would bring folks together and hold space for civil discourse to make sure that all voices are represented in the conversation for a for consensus to be built.
Thank you. David Zuckerman.
Well, let's just remember it's almost impossible to place these kinds of facilities in any community these days because people have fear and prejudice around the circumstances. What we need to do is work to make sure that facility, if it's there, is built securely and safely, and then also make sure the community has the supports and resources it needs in case something were to happen that would affect people in the community. But for the most part, I think it's really important to recognize we need to make sure there's professionals in the area to do the work and keep it safe and help those people.
Thank you. And Representative Kimball.
Yeah, thank you. First, Woodside did need to be shut down. Let's just not avoid that. But we do need an alternative. We can't have 15-year-olds being held in adult correctional facilities. So we do need a solution. Windsor has been asked for a very long time to house corrections facilities, and I understand why they don't want to have that anymore. And Springfield, they have the same kind of history with correctional facilities, but they arranged to have an agreement with the state that benefited the town as well. So it would be a process of working with different communities to figure out what is possible, what are you willing to accept.
Thank you. And we are actually going to move on now to our lightning round before the end of the debate. Here, please keep your answers as short as possible. We're talking 10 seconds or less. Question number one, who is the non-politician you admire most? David Zuckerman.
My dad.
Charlie Kimball.
I would say my wife.
Kitty Toll.
I would say my mother, a real strong spirit.
Thank you. And Patricia Preston.
Not a politician, but an advocate for the agricultural communities at our town meeting days is my grandfather, who has since passed.
Thank you. Question number two, how important is it to be from Vermont to serve in a role like Lieutenant Governor? Representative Kimball.
Born in Vermont?
Born in Vermont.
Being as I was born in Massachusetts, moved here when I was three, I would say very low. But Vermonters are people who have chosen to live here. We have to get away from this thing is that you're not from Vermont unless you're born here.
Thank you. Yeah. Kitty Toll.
I believe we need to become a very welcoming state, and a welcoming state means we welcome them into our state government as well. So it's not a high priority for me. Welcome everybody.
Patricia Preston.
Well, as my entire career has been focused on bringing people to the state and inclusivity, I would say it has no bearing on the role.
David Zuckerman.
I would say someone's experience, integrity, positions on issues, life realities and experiences are what's most important. Where you're born is irrelevant.
All right. And last question. We'll end with a fun one. What is one item you would bring with you to a desert island? All right. Let's start with Kitty Toll.
I would bring a book, but then that would be gone very quickly. So maybe, one of the iPad readers so I could read several books.
Clever. Representative Kimball.
I would bring a fishing pole so I could survive.
Also very smart. Patricia Preston.
I'm not sure if my rescue dog counts, but I think that's what I would go with.
That counts. David Zuckerman.
Solar-powered desalination device.
Ooh. Good answer as well. All right. Well, it is time now for our one-minute closing statements from each candidate. The order was predetermined randomly before the show, and Representative Kimball, you will start us off.
Well, thank you. It is easy to get discouraged by politics today. The shouting from the extremes is deafening, making the voices in the middle nearly impossible to hear. But that is where the work gets done, in the middle. Engaging all people, asking questions, listening, shaping laws and policies that are fair, equitable, and sustainable. That gets us closer to our goals of environmental stewardship, social justice, freedom and unity, economic opportunity and independence. I am in the middle, a moderate Democrat with extensive experience both in and out of government. I want to use the office of Lieutenant Governor to bring together those who share a vision for Vermont, where anyone who is willing to work hard and gain skills can have a meaningful career. A Vermont that is affordable for all of us in housing, childcare, and everyday life expenses. A Vermont with an unsurpassed quality of life, clean air and clean water, where all are welcome, where rural communities thrive, where our children and our families are safe. That is what I want to see in Vermont. I hope you join me and vote for Charlie on August 9th.
Patricia Preston, it is your turn for a closing statement.
For far too long, the same people have occupied the same seats in Montpelier. And let's be clear, the world is on fire. Families cannot afford to live here, wages are stagnant, my peers cannot afford to have children, and women's rights are under threat. We cannot afford to look to the past for solutions. Now is the time for a new era of leadership in Montpelier. As leader of a statewide organization, I am in a unique position to deliver results that incorporate the voices of all Vermonters. Together, we will make childcare affordable. We will make housing affordable and build a green economy and strengthen our rural communities. We are in the midst of a sea change in Vermont politics. An unprecedented number of legislators are retiring this election cycle, making way for new and fresh ideas. The Lieutenant Governor's office should reflect that change. We need new leadership to move our state forward to build a future that belongs to everyone. I'm asking you to join our campaign today to fulfill the promise of Vermont. Visit our website, patriciaforvermont.com, donate, sign up, and get involved today.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Kitty Toll, your closing statement.
Thank you. And thank you to VPR and PBS today for holding this debate and allowing us to have a conversation with Vermonters. I also want to thank the other candidates on the stage with me. I know we all care about a good future for this state. As Lieutenant Governor, I look forward to bringing experience and purpose to the office, elevating the voices of Vermonters and continuing the work as a consensus builder to address important issues, including building our economy, universal access to broadband, housing for everyone, and affordable, accessible childcare, and of course, a commitment to addressing climate change. We must work hard together to create a state that we are proud of to pass on to the next generation and to future generations to come. I want to be your next Lieutenant Governor, and I am committed to working with all Vermonters, regardless of political party, just as I have done in Montpelier. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, in our randomly generated order is David Zuckerman, your closing statement.
Thank you. As a farmer, father, small business owner, 18-year legislator, 4-year lieutenant governor, I bring the most experience to lead in these difficult times. Vermonters are feeling a lot of heavy issues: the COVID pandemic, high housing costs, fuel prices that are squeezing families living paycheck to paycheck. Nationwide, our democracy is under siege. We have a lack of childcare, and the climate is heavy on all of our minds. I've received endorsements from Vermont State Employees Association, the AFL-CIO, the Professional Firefighters, Sunrise Montpelier, Rights and Democracy, and more, because I have a track record of successfully tackling big issues, such as marriage equality, raising the minimum wage, medical aid and dying, building more affordable housing in our town and village centers, cannabis reform, and numerous climate initiatives. I've collaboratively worked with tens of thousands of Vermonters from all backgrounds and all political persuasions to make good policy. I'm asking for your vote because today's urgency issues demand the experience, bold leadership, and diplomatic skills that I offer. Please visit ZuckermanForVT.com. Thank you.
All right, this concludes the primary election debate for Democrats running for Lieutenant Governor on VPR and Vermont PBS. Thank you to the candidates who joined us today: former Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman of Hinesburg, former Danville Representative Kitty Toll, Burlington's Patricia Preston, president of the nonprofit Vermont Council on World Affairs, and Representative Charlie Kimball of Woodstock. The VPR Vermont PBS debates are produced by Matthew Smith, Tedra Meyer, Brian Stevenson, Holt Albee, Mike Dunn, David Rice, Frank Allwine, and Peter Angish and Jen Jarecki. Our music is by Eric E. Wazen and the New Trombone Collective. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for being here, and we'll catch up again soon.